episode 99 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray. We are recording on the 13th of September 2020. On other shows from Fourspire Podcasts, Binge On has four Tamil movies with excellent soundtracks. And WhatsApp Geeks, well, we discuss Xbox news, the upcoming Apple iPhone event, and Android 11. And now, back to our show and your host, who hopefully isn't living in what looks like a post-apocalyptic world with a gorgeous but bizarre sky, Arnab Ray. Hey, Arnab.
Hi, Vikram.
Arnab, is your sky blue, I'm hoping?
No, it's not. Right now, for the last 2 days, it has been gray. And that's not because there are clouds in the sky, but because of the smoke that has kind of surrounded everything. So it's hot as hell because it's a warm day, actually. The sun is actually there, but there is just an almost continuous covering of smoke, which is not as spectacularly orange as not, as somebody had said, Sunk Francisco on Twitter. It doesn't have that whole Hindutva thing. It's just friggin' gray, that's all.
I didn't know that was a thing. Okay, that's clever though.
At least San Francisco the Northern California looks beautiful. The only thing is there's not been any fire in the vicinity. We had one in October last year that led to us being evacuated from our homes. It was quite a nightmare. But the fact is that staying in Los Angeles and over the last few years, the fire situation, because of global warming, I would say, I mean, it's not me saying this, it's just become, it's kind of tipped that, you know, it's kind of crossed that tipping point where now it's basically an existential threat to the state. It used to always be the case. But over the last few years, there has been a progression. It's normally what happens is there's a bad fire season and then 2 years, it's okay. And then there's another bad fire season. Now it's nothing like this. Now every year is a bad fire season with things actually getting worse every year. So it's only a matter of time before we have to get evacuated. And I, of course, the moment I moved into California, I've always, you know, second guessed the decision to move into California. And I think now many other people are also thinking this. My brother-in-law, who normally really likes California, stayed here for the last, I would say almost like last 18 or 19 years. He's never left the state, but even he was saying that, you know, he's a long-term California resident, unlike me. He was saying, yeah, things are actually getting a little crazy. This wasn't the case before. Even 3 or 4 years ago, this wasn't the case. But now it's basically at every year, you have to be reconciled to the fact that you will have to be evacuated from your home because of fire. Besides, of course, the very real risk of your house actually burning down in a fire. That's also, of course, there. Now, having said that, California is very good at fighting fires. They work with amazing efficiency. And one of the few things that I've seen in the US which actually works in terms of an element of its infrastructure is the whole firefighting infrastructure in California. So it has to be seen to be believed how efficient they are. But even they can't. The firefighting force is not meant for, you know, this level of engagement with forest fires. Anyways, moving on to the stories for today. So the first big real story, of course, is what the thing that is I would say the most sensational, the most important thing. That's all I want to start with. For India today, it has been the battle between Ashok Dinda and Ranadev Bose, which, that's another thing that the Sushant Singh story has led to be suppressed. Besides, of course, the precipitous fall in our GDP. You know, what's the scandal? Why aren't people talking about Dinda abusing Ranadev Bose? I personally had no idea. There's a Crickinfo article which I had just tweeted. If you're interested in Dinda talking about his stellar performance, please read that. It's possibly is the funniest thing I've read in a while, because it's actually a battle between Dinda, Arun Lal, and Ranadev Bose. I mean, what a crazy trio to be fighting, and it's possibly is Crickinfo's best bit of cricket journalism for the last few years, I would say. And now all of you know what a big fan of Ashok Dinda I am. And as I've said before in the podcast, I knew that there was something wrong with Vijay Mallya's business and his business acumen when in a post-auction interview, he said that we had a great auction. You know, we snagged some great pace bowling talent like Ashok Dhinda. I knew there was something very wrong with him at that point of time. As wrong, perhaps even worse, is so-called Justice Karju, who continues to remain a disgrace. Today, he basically shilled for Nirav Modi in a deposition to UK, saying that in India, he would not get a fair trial. This is coming from a Supreme Court judge, by the way, an ex-Supreme Court judge. And the fact that this man, and I use the word man with trepidation, let's say, this man continues to get the prominence that he gets, and he will do anything for attention. He will do just say anything and do anything for attention. He represents, and again, if he was just an old man trying to get a place in the sun, it would be okay. But the fact is that he carries with him the gravitas of having been a member of India's top judicial body, and to see some, you know, see this level, see this from him, it's just, I can't think of any other word other than disgrace. So the Sushant Singh story and Riya Chakravarti story goes on, and I guess all angles of the story have been done everywhere. And we've had enough fun on Arnab Goswami and why things are as they are. I don't know if you saw the TRP ratings, but
Republic
basically is eating everybody's lunch and dinner and breakfast. And they've knocked Aajtak out of their top post. So I don't know who got justice, whether it was I don't think anybody will ever get justice, but Arnab Goswami sure got a fat paycheck. And again, as I said in the last podcast, that it's very easy to, you know, point fingers at an Arnab Goswami, and you know, but you know, at any point of time, there's a market for something. There will be somebody who, and that's what capitalism is. The real thing is, why is there a market for that? That is what people should be asking. So rather than making fun of Arnab Goswami or pointing fingers at him, the main thing is introspection as to why we want that kind of news. The fact is, none of us do want to hear stories about GDP. Any channel, as I said before, if you were really interested in hearing stories about GDP, you would turn on to NDTV, and you don't. So the fact is that there will always be, if there's a market for something, there will naturally be, because that is in the very nature of capitalism. Or you should have Doordarshan, which is, you know, government controlled. We decide what is good for you. And if it's Krishi Darshan at 7, that's exactly what you're going to get. So we've gone through that. We've gone through, here's the TV which is good for you. And it wasn't particularly good for us at all. Most of it was government propaganda, and some of it was good programming. There was UGC, and there was Professor Yashpal teaching you what a tuning fork was. But guess how many people watched that? The only thing people really watched was 15 minutes of Spider-Man at 1:30 on Sunday. So the fact is that television news is entertainment. And we switch on the television for entertainment. And if you're able to get entertainment from the news, if you're able to get entertainment from Arnab Goswami shouting, what, mujhe MDM lao, mujhe drugs lao, and all that. And that's obviously entertaining. You're watching it because of the meltdown, because most people have become kind of inured to reality shows. I think everybody nowadays knows that reality shows are scripted. So I think that's pretty much common knowledge nowadays. But with the news program, I mean, it's scripted too in a way, but you can say that, you know, Sushant Singh, in that whole thing, the chase sequence where, you know, one Republic television reporter, you know, actually chases Riya Chakravarti or her brother, you know, those things are actually reality TV, because you don't know when they're going to show up. So there's something asynchronous about that. So if this is actually the only true measure of reality TV that a reality TV starved audience can find. But again, the real thing that I've been thinking of as I've watched this, you know, breathtaking coverage of Riya Chakravarti is there anybody out there listening to the program whose mind has changed over the last 2 months, two or 3 months? What I want to say is that if you thought on day one that you heard the story, if you thought that Sushant Singh Rajput committed suicide, did the coverage make you change your mind? If you thought that the Shiv Sena and the Bombay police, Mumbai police are doing a great job, did you change your mind at all? And the flip side, if you thought that Sushant Singh Rajput was murdered, what evidence would convince you to think that it was a suicide? And I'm absolutely sure that there's very few, if any, whose mind has actually changed. Because I think we live in a world where opinions cannot change. By definition, it cannot change. Because there is no incentive for us to change our opinions. At some point of time, we sometimes changed in the 80s, we sometimes changed our opinions to fit in with the group that we were in. So even if we didn't agree, we kind of pretended to agree, and perhaps we convinced ourselves to agree to something because we were always with a group of people that was usually would be family. However, now with social media, you can always find a group of people who have the exact same worldview as you do, the exact same. So you don't need, and that's why friendships get broken. That's why people are unfriended on Facebook. That's why people, because relatives, friends, classmates, we no longer have to agree with them. We no longer have to be part of the group. We are free to choose our own group. So if you are hashtag justice for Sushant, and you have nobody in your circle who thinks that Sushant Singh Rajput was murdered, guess what? You can pretty much kick all of them out of your life, and you will find more than you can replace one person with 10 people online. And this, I think, is very dangerous to discussion, debate, and in general for humanity, that nothing really nowadays can change our minds. Those people who thought that Riya Chakravarti has been defrauding Sushant Singh Rajput, they haven't been convinced at all by the fact that she has been cleared by the ED. For them, it is, of course, she was going to get cleared by the ED. This is all a political thing. Of course, she's covered her tracks. Of course, she's a super genius. If you ask them, well, the fact that we started off with Sushant Singh Rajput was murdered, and now we have gone to who had how many grams of ganja, you know, is there something which doesn't quite, and are you willing to at this point of time to concede that, yeah, maybe Sushant Singh Rajput was, you know, did have emotional issues and he committed suicide? And the answer to it is absolutely no. This is all a cover up. Of course, they say, what else are you going to find? The Mumbai police removed all evidence. This is all a setup. Of course, you know, when the locksmith came, why did they just shoo the locksmith away? Why didn't they let the locksmith into the room? You can say, well, maybe the people who called the locksmith had kind of an idea that he had done something, and whether he had committed suicide, whether he was dead or whether he was near dead, they just didn't want the locksmith to see it, recognize the celebrity, and then go ahead and sell his story to the paparazzi. Maybe they didn't want that. But no, there is, I mean, that could be, or it could be that they wanted to cover up. We'll never know. But the fact is that everybody's mind is pre-decided, and nothing in terms of facts or evidence will change their minds, because our opinions align. We choose the opinions that align with our view of how the world works. So if this whole thing seems to you to be patriarchy, as per the t-shirt that Riya Chakravarti wore, then it is so. Everything is a conspiracy because Riya Chakravarti is a female. It could be. It might not be. We don't know. I mean, at least I have no opinion on that. But the fact is that, and I see this increasingly with my friends and whenever I see a discussion, not one person is willing to change their opinion. And the same person will say to the other side, oh, why aren't you looking at the facts? Why aren't you trusting the investigations of CBI? These same people in another context will say, I don't believe a word of what happened to Justice Loya. That's absolutely a cover-up by the evil Modi and Amit Shah. I mean, nothing, that he was murdered. And you can go and point out and say, well, look, the facts just don't line up with that in terms of what's, but who cares about what the facts are? Who cares? The police is compromised. The judiciary is compromised. It happened. But right now, the judiciary is not compromised. The police are not compromised. Whatever they say should be trusted at face value. So this is, again, a persistent theme in our podcast, is that centrism is standing by a set of consistent principles. It's not necessarily the arithmetic mean of left and right. It is taking a consistent set of principles. If you believe the courts, if you believe the law, if you believe that, then you have to consistently believe it. You cannot choose to believe in them when it's convenient for you or when it aligns with what you have pre-decided that you will believe in. That's the important thing. This is nothing but faith. This is nothing but religious dogma at this point of time. Religious dogma in a secular cover. That's exactly what it is. People who shout about secularism are not secular at all. They just have a different identification of what their religion is. They are dogmatic and fundamentalist, like the worst of religious fundamentalists, because they have no principles. They will change the goal, we will shift the goalposts, they will change their principles in order for the facts to align with what their worldview is. This is why people in Europe had so much trouble believing that the earth was round, or even when the evidence was presented to them. They just couldn't believe it. So these were considered to be not facts. Even in the US, there are still some states where Darwinism cannot be taught. Or even when it's taught, it has to be a caveat that this is a theory. There's also another theory that God came and created human beings. And so these, both of them are like theories. And they're absolutely not. One of them is actually backed by evidence, and the other is backed by nothing. But it doesn't matter at this point of time. So this, again,
I mean, you're talking about current day where evolution is still being disputed in schools?
Yes. Yes. So there are, for instance, in some of the red states, there are places, because over here in the US, school boards and local county school boards, state school boards have a huge amount of influence in what gets taught. So America, this is, I think, very specific to America. There's a lot of local autonomy in terms of these things. I mean, one of the biggest things that which in the US I believe is crazy is that you have states which issue driver's licenses. So when you move from one state to another, you have to redo the whole goddamn process again. So it's like moving to a different country. And so, yes, so education boards there's still pitched battles fought in some school districts in Texas as to whether, Darwinism is a theory, whether if you teach Darwinism, you also have to teach the Christian, God created man in, 6 days and rested on the seventh day, that's also a theory that you have to teach as if that is on par with Darwinism. So, this exists because, and again, you can be radically skeptical about everything. So the people who believe in creationism are radically skeptical when it comes to Darwinism. They will take every aspect and say, well, have you ever seen, of course, most of this are based on not understanding what the theory of evolution is. Have you ever seen an ape, next generation becoming a human being? Has anybody ever seen that? So they're hyper skeptical when it comes to this. But they're absolutely not skeptical at all about the supreme being who creates human beings in 6 days and rests on the seventh. That to them, there's absolutely no skepticism on that. So this is the cornerstone of what religious fundamentalism is. And when I look at online discussions nowadays, I see people who normally won't even recognize themselves as religious fundamentalists. They are actually that. because none of this changes opinions. I mean, Arnab Goswami isn't there to change any opinion. He's not there as, and people say, you know, that he should talk about the starving farmers, he should talk about COVID. I'm not so sure about that. I think as a person who runs a commercial channel and who profits from it, he will talk about whatever the market wants him to talk about. That part I'm kind of okay with. What I'm not okay with, and again, when I say I'm not okay with, I also understand why he does that. But neither is NDTV or neither is Sar Desai. None of them are in the business of actually trying to engage and change minds. None of them are. They're only interested in just like the clergy. You know, they effectively have taken that spot.
I mean, you mentioned, I think last week or something, that you select your news channel based on your slant, right? I mean,
exactly. And now if you look at Arnab Goswami, sometimes he seems to be like one of these fire and brimstone, you know, preachers at a pulpit. I mean, that's exactly how he presents his news. I mean, he starts off with a 10-minute rant on morality. And at that point of time, there's no difference between what he does and what a leader of a cult would do, or a religion. There is really no difference. If you deconstruct, you know, the way he speaks. And by the way, I don't know if there were two Republic journalists who quit. One of them gave a... And, you know, I have little sympathy for people who work for Republic and say that they didn't see this coming. Because, I mean, I'm sorry, man. I can't take you seriously if you join Republic TV in your full full functioning mind without unless you're drunk, and then you suddenly realize, wait, what? This is Republic TV? Of course. You know, so I also think this is terrible in terms of, you know, being a professional, where after you quit your job, you decide to go and, you know, trash talk your ex-employer. I think it's a terrible career move for anybody, no matter what you feel. If you feel like that you're not, and that could happen. It often happens that you join an organization, the organization's shift and management change, and then the management might not change, their shift changes, and you realize you're not comfortable with that. You quit. You don't go and make a spectacle out of it, because I don't think it, I mean, people do it because, you know, speaking about against Arnab Goswami gets you a lot of, you know, gets you a lot of claps, gets you a lot of retweets, and people like that. I mean, it makes them feel like they have like their 5 seconds of fame, but in general, this is a terrible career move, because, you know, as one of my friends, Nirmala Dutta, who's in Free Press Journal, pointed out in one of his tweets, every other channel is headed by somebody exactly like Arnab Goswami. And then today they might be saying, wow, yes, but yeah, cool. But they also realize that, you know, if you come to their channel, you might do the same thing to them. So all channels are run like this. I mean, all of them, there's no difference. It's just that Arnab Goswami takes it to a different level of narcissism that other people may not, but they're going to follow. As the TRP numbers show, again, I don't think it's less of who Arnab Goswami is and more the persona that he finds sells. And you kind of see that throughout. So I think that as I've delved into philosophy, you know, this whole thing about truth being subjective, of course, when the ancient philosophers talked about the subjectiveness of truth, it was more about, you know, your frame of observation, you know, where you're seeing something from, and the fact that there is nothing which is other than mathematics, some said, and other than the fact that you have, but even your axioms, even the starting point that you have for all algebras, even they are assumptions. So, but I'm not talking about it from that philosophical point of view, but we've reached a stage where, honestly, saying something is fake news, when Trump says this is fake news, it is in a way fake news. I mean, I think I understand. If people say Trump points to somebody and the real truth, and he says, no, that's not real. It's fake news. But so Trump is lying. But he is lying, of course. But there's something deeper going on. The fact is, to his supporters, it is fake news. Because facts don't matter. Any fact that you get, you can be radically skeptical about it and say, I will take apart the assumptions on which that fact is made. If it is made on the basis of a court judgment, I will say that the courts are biased. If it is made on the basis of what the police have done or what a law enforcement agency has done, I will go and attack the very basis of that law enforcement agency. If I like what they say, I will say, but the law enforcement agency said it. Oh, but the court said it. This is exactly why Narendra Modi is still guilty of genocide by the exact same people, who are saying that. What now about Riya Chakravarti? Well, you couldn't prove anything now, could you now? Now do you see how innocent she is? But Modi, he isn't innocent, of course. So this is exactly what the problem is. They will trust the CBI when it comes to Riya Chakravarti. They'll trust the ED, but they won't trust the Supreme Court. They won't trust the High Court when it comes to Narendra Modi. Because, you know, that's their bias. Because they have decided, they have already pre-decided what their truth is. And they will cherry pick. And they will support institutions and oppose them based on whether they agree or disagree in specific instances with what they believe the truth to be. Which is a question that I've often been getting, so I wanted to spend some time to answer it.
Yep.
Which is a question on time management. Right, Vikram?
Absolutely. A lot of people wrote in asking for this. So this is all.
So what's the question? So why don't you frame the question?
Well, I think the question came in from the fact that, in fact, I don't know, but I think like you mentioned, one of them was snarky or sincere, that you seem to be juggling a lot of balls. Yeah, this came in especially when you mentioned that you had finished the first draft of your textbook. And so people wanted to know how you are juggling so many things, writing textbooks, your day job, parenting, and within quotes, being on Twitter all the time.
Yes, exactly. So if these questions, and I've been asked this multiple times, even if they come from a point of view of snarkiness, let me try to answer the question. Not so much as to how I manage time, which again, might be me stepping into the trap that has been set for me, but in general, talk about what I believe about time management. So that I kind of turn it around from, hey, Arnab, you're super. Tell me the secret of your superness, which I believe could be sarcastic. I'm going to turn that question around and say, okay, leaving aside what I do, let's talk about what I believe time management is. So the first thing about time management in today's modern world, and so first let's define what the problem is. The problem is that we want to be able to do everything. And we find ourselves often letting things slide, not being able to devote our time to our hobbies, to family. I mean, of course, we all have to devote our time to our office and, you know, what pays the bills. But then we often find this, time passes, you get old and you say, I wish I had more time to do something. And this is very, very important. So the first thing that everybody should tell themselves all the time, and we tend to forget it, is that your primary asset that you have in this world is not what's in your bank, it's time. If luck gives you, let's say, 70 years on this world, then 70 years is your asset. That is what you have been given. It's not the money you make, but the time. We make money so that we can, when we make money, what we usually do is we spend a bit of our time to get something that allows us to spend the rest of our time better. So the purpose of earning money isn't in itself. It's not earning money for money's sake, which unfortunately is what happens to most of us, which is why we end up losing the time. So this is the fundamental principle of why people find themselves short of time because they don't optimize on time. They optimize on the secondary attribute, which is money. And that's the fatal flaw, because you're basically optimizing on the secondary parameter, not on the primary one, which is why you will always end up making suboptimal decisions based on that, because you're choosing, you're following the wrong variable, essentially. So again, think of this in this way. You have so many seconds of your life from the day you were born. Now you take a choice. You decide based on the way you were brought up, what you learned, what your parents told you, that look, in order for me to have the most amount of happiness from this time, because that's all that I'm going to have at the end of my 70 years on this life, and that's usually what happens to most of us, we do have money left over in the bank for most of us. We don't actually spend all our money, but we definitely, by definition, have spent all our time. So that should tell you which one is more important, straight off. One, it's nothing you can do about it. The other one, you're always going to have, generally always going to have more than what you can do. Now, time. So the first thing is that choose a job that suits you. So when you are going to be making money, when you decide that, okay, and everybody has to make money. If you don't make money, then all the time that we have is going to be terrible, right? So, but there is, and I'll give an example of what, so when I was in class 12, we sat for our joint entrance examinations. So my math tutor says that out of 200, you should always answer, you should not aim to answer more than 130. So his logic was 130 is the optimum amount of things. After 130, you should just go back and check what you did. You should not try to score more than 130. And you're not going to get 130 either. You're obviously going to make mistakes. But if you try to go for 140, you will get much, much worse than you if you just settled with 130. So there is, after that, you have basically gone over. So that's the time money thing. So when people say, how do you manage time? Presuming they're asking it for that they really want to know. The shortest answer to it is I'm very conscious of, I try to be, sometimes I fail at that too. I sometimes do get blindsided by other things, other shinier objects, because time, it's not a shiny object. It just kind of passes. But the main thing is I always tell myself, is this what I want to be doing? Is this making me happy? So one of the things that I chose personally was that I chose a job throughout my life. After I graduated with my PhD, I've always chosen a job that has allowed me to spend time on other things in terms of writing, in terms of, even in order to write, you need to read, you need to watch television in terms of news, and I write a movie, so I have to watch movies. So, you know, it's just not a question of writing. I mean, for every line written, there's perhaps a lot of effort expended to even get there. So one of the things that I think is a vital thing that people should, and I'm glad that at least I personally, very early in my life, a lot of decisions which I've taken in my life without a single bit of thought or self-introspection. But after I'd done my PhD, I think I was at that point of time, I had a sufficiently decent idea about who I was as a human being. Not before that, mind you, but around that time. So for the secret of time management is always to choose a job that provides you that optimum balance where you're expending the time to make enough money that will support the thing that you really want to do in that T minus T time, capital T minus small t time that you have. So that's hitting that mark. So that's what I've consistently, personally tried to hit throughout my life. I do not want to work in positions that would take away that deterministic, I work for this amount of time, then there are some jobs which are like that. There are certain corporate cultures which are like that. That you have to, the work basically expands to fill your day. And that's a choice that you take. And you might go join a place and you find that the work is exactly like that. It's in your hand at that point of time to leave. Because it is important, because you're definitely not going to get your time back. That is so, so, so important. You're not going to get your time back. You can go to another job, you can take a pay cut, you can move to another part of the country, and none of the, and all of these will consume time. Yes, they will consume time, but it will still, the loss of time that you have, because remember, there's no absolute gain of value to time. In order to get something from your time, you usually end up losing something. And that's part of any kind of investment. When you get a high return on your investment, you're basically selling your peace of mind to get that. So nothing comes for free. And so first thing is, choose a job that allows you to spend that amount of time that you believe you need in order for you to feel fulfilled. Because remember, it's how much happiness you get in the amount of time that you have in this world. That is what you're trying to maximize. Money is just one way of trying to attaining that. There are other ways. The second thing is learn to multitask. So learn to do two things at the same time. So again, I'll take a personal example. I like to take about an hour's walk every day. So that, first of all, it's a physical, I mean, it's an exercise. I'm at the age where I need to do that. But that 1 hour isn't just, the reason why I walk, for instance, and why I don't, let's say, run, is because when I run, I'm so tired that I cannot concentrate on what I'm listening to, or I can't think. And you're not supposed to. When you're running, you can only listen to thump, thump, thump music, because your body is not, you know, you're exerting in a different way. But if you walk, not true. I mean, you're in full possession of your faculties at this point of time. So I use that 1 hour to listen to podcasts. I use that time sometimes not to listen to anything, but just to think. I just think about how I'm going to lay out the chapters in my book. I might be stuck on something and I kind of go through it in my head. And you can say, well, why can't you go through it? And the fact is that 1 hour that I have when I'm walking, I'm not looking at my phone. There's no distraction. I am able to concentrate on that problem much better than if I was sitting in front of the computer and trying to think while trying to write. Because then I would go to another tab. I would open Twitter. I would open Crick Info. I would do all these other things. So the fact that walking time I'm able to use for thinking, as well as I get my 10,000 steps in, that's how you manage time. The third thing, and that's often not sufficiently given credit, is that one of the things that really take away your time, if you look at it at the end of your life, is the amount of drama that there is in relationships. I'm not just talking about romantic relationships. I'm talking about relationships with your parents, relationships with your siblings, relationships with your boss, relationships with your children. Drama in relationships is a huge, huge time killer without providing any benefit in terms of happiness. So when I say drama, obviously I mean the negative parts of any relationship. I'm not talking about the good parts. Of course, the good part is a good utilization of time for happiness. But the ability, so people who have good time management were able to get much more out of their lives than you believe you have. One question you may want to, of course, you might never know the answer, is how stable were they in their relationships? Did they have a very good functional marriage, you know, or relationship, a romantic relationship? Did they have a good relationship with their parents? Did they have a good relationship with their children? These things, of course, there's going to be There's nothing perfect, of course. But in general, in my life, I've seen that at least my friends who had excessive drama in their romantic relationships, excessive drama, they never reached where I believe they would have reached if based on their potential that I had seen in terms of, you know, how smart they were. It just didn't work out. It just filled up their time and sapped their emotional energy in a way. And this is not just one or two people, every one of them. So that's another important thing. And the last thing that I would say, and again, I've said this before, and I think this is very important, is that you have to realize your limitations. Again, you have a limited amount of seconds in this life. So while you're perfectly fine to explore different things and see, okay, this is I'm good at, this I'm not that good at, this thing I'm not good at, but I would really, really want to be good at this. Or this thing I'm really very good at, but I just hate doing it. So yeah, there's some amount of exploration, but there is, and this is where the happiness industry, the TEDx talks, and the Varun Pruthis, and that what Shetty, what that guy is, and where this industry tells you something which is objectively true. No, you cannot be everything you want to be. That is not true. You cannot be that. And this is one of the biggest wastages of time. Not just people listening to that crap, but people then internalizing that crap shit and then trying to attain something that they were never going to be able to attain. No, you cannot attain everything. Yes, as you grow older, you are less likely to attain some things. When you are 10 years old, yeah, maybe the world, you can be anything you want to be. Technically, that's also not true, but it's perhaps more true than if you said this to a 40-year-old person. It just isn't. As the sand falls through the hourglass, your potential decreases. There's no other way of putting it. This is the tragedy of time passing. It's not nothing else. I mean, of course, your health deteriorates and everything goes down. But you can say, you know what? I work out. Look at Simi Grewal. Does she look any different than 1970s? And no, she doesn't. But all that's, it's not the cosmetic part that I'm talking about. It's not talking about looking old, which some people don't. You know, if you work out, you know, you may be able to roll back time. I mean, I've seen people who look younger than they were when they were actually, they look younger in their 40s than they were in 20s because they've, you know, really worked on their physique. So I'm not talking about that, but no matter what you do with your body, your potential, you just don't have the time. There's just some things. First of all, you don't have the time. Second is you have baggage. You carry relationships. You carry marriages. You carry kids. And of course, the happiness industry will say, just quit what you're doing and, you know, get on your journey. It's never too late to learn the guitar. No, it is. It actually is. And the biggest waste of time I've seen is people who imbibe this poison and then start spending their time, which basically is they don't have a lot of, pursuing things that will not make them happy. Because they're not going to attain, because they just will not have the time. They cannot do it anymore. That the ship has literally sailed for them, and then they spend all this time that they could spend much more profitably being comfortable with what they are, with coming to terms with their successes and failures, realizing, no, I'm not going to be able to be this. And I'm not saying that this is a happy realization. I'm not saying that you should be happy about it. The realization might make you sad, but pursuing something which you're not going to get or reasonably going to get, there might be an off chance that you might get it. But if you do that, then you are going to have that sense of sadness. Not today. So if today somebody comes to me and says, Arnab, you could be the CEO of Microsoft if you want. I say, you know what? That's exactly what I'm going to try to do. Now I'm going to, there's some point of time where the penny is going to drop and I'm going to realize that that's not going to happen to me. So the sadness that I would have felt today, I will feel, let's say 10 years down the line when I finally realize it's not going to happen. But by that time, there's going to be the added sadness of me knowing that I just wasted 10 years of my life going for that, which I'm not going to have today. So you are going, that sadness of not attaining, you're going to have anyways. If you're trying to pursue your dream, you're just going to accrue the sadness of the time that you've wasted. Because remember what I started this discussion off by saying, that the happiness you have in the amount of time you have, that's what you should be trying to optimize. So a related question as we conclude with this, when I talked about disappointment and sadness, is how do you cope with, given that you realize there are some things which, you know, things don't happen the way you want them to, you realize that some things are never going to happen for you despite you trying, it's not going to happen. How do you cope with that? How do you even come to terms with that? And I will revert to what Buddhism basically says. It's not just Buddhism. It's part of Stoic philosophy also. So, you know, people say, you know, people got ideas of, you know, who came up with it, nobody knows. But Buddhism, Hinduism, you know, I don't want to get into that thing, you know, oh, it's really our idea. No. So the main three things is there is, so this is, again, not, I'm not going to get into argument whether it was Hinduism or Buddhism and whether they were, but the basic Buddhist philosophy, one part is that there are three things really that you should always remember to cope with disappointment. One is that we have no way of knowing at the present point of time what good is in terms of making you happy. So if you don't get something, if you don't get a job or if you don't get whatever it is that you wanted, you have no idea that from a global perspective, that would have been good for you. At this point of time, it does look to be good for you. But from a global perspective, we have no idea that that path that you're going to go on, that path in the timeline is going to end up good for you. It is the exact same thing with bad. So when something terrible happens, of course, the terrible thing has happened. But you have no idea knowing whether that terrible thing ultimately will lead to something good. You have no idea. Now, there's a third thing in Buddhism, which I don't agree with, is that it's all karma. That is all a notion of good things leading to good and bad things leading to bad, which I absolutely do not buy. Because for me, it's all random. I mean, this
does karma mean predestination?
No, it's karma. At least the Buddhist ideal of karma doesn't actually mean that. It just basically means that there's a causality. Karma basically means causality. That means good things lead to good and bad things lead to bad. And that's the Buddhist way of doing it. The Stoics said something different. The Stoics said that there is, and that's why Stoic philosophy, some people say, kind of grew up to become Christian philosophy, is that everything has been fixed by a higher authority. So again, Buddhism says, good things lead to good, bad things lead to bad. So you don't, I mean, that's why you don't know whether something is good or bad, because you don't know that. And the Stoic philosophy or Christian philosophy says, you know, it's all preordained. You know, there's some higher being which decides. For me, I don't believe in any of them, of course. For me, it's totally random. And that's why the first two philosophy things hold. You don't know whether something is good and you don't know something is bad. In the exact same way, you don't know before a coin is tossed whether it's going to come up head or tail. That's the reason why you don't know. Because your life from that point on is a series of coin flips and you cannot predict. Now, does that mean that we don't do anything? No, it doesn't mean that. One of the things that I tell myself is that the way I look at this world is, have any of you played role-playing games, RPGs? Have you played role-playing games?
I'm playing a couple right now.
So the classic role-playing game, something called turn-based, you know, that whole combat system. If you've played Knights of the Old Republic, okay.
Right.
The way it works is that you have a set of, like, when you come up with against an enemy, they have a set of attributes and you have a set of attributes. Okay. Now, on top of that attributes, there's a random roll of dice. There's a random probability assigned, and that probability defines basically who wins or who loses or who has the upper hand. That, I believe, is the closest approximation to how the world works. So everybody, it's not that, you know, oh, that means everything is random, so I don't need to study. I'll just sit at home and just play games and everything will sort itself out. Or random, who knows? Maybe I'll become Bill Gates. It's all random, right? It's all a lottery. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the model of the way a role-played RPG combat system works is the model of the way the world works. So you have your own attributes. You have to build up your own attributes. You have to build up your own skill tree. That goes without saying. But just because you have the skill tree doesn't mean that if you go up against, if you're level 40 and you go up against an enemy which is level 20, that you'll always prevail over the level 20 guy. That also doesn't mean, because level 20 guy is going to have certain advantages. He's going to have the random roll of, he's going to have that die, roll of the die. So that thing remains. So you, all that you can do, and this comes to Stoic philosophy, is just try to do the things that you have in control. That's it. And that means things that, you know, self-improvement, studying, that kind of thing. It's nothing else. Anything that does not involve somebody else thinking anything of you, which again, you cannot control. That's the only thing which you should strive for. Everything else, at least, is the way I cope with disappointment, is just to think, you know, that it's just a roll of dice. You know, when I go up against somebody else, that person has certain other advantages that I don't have. And I said this in one of the early podcasts, that, you know, growing up middle class, we believe that the only thing that should matter is your intelligence and your merit. But that's not the way the world works. Your intelligence and merit is just one of the many things that make you successful in life. There are a lot of other things that you might not have. I mean, you just, you know, just your disposition, the way you talk, the way you come across, your membership in, you know, certain classes, in terms of, there are, like, in the US, it used to be that, you know, if you were a white male, you had the die loaded for you at one point, right? There's no way anybody's going to, in a role-playing game, you've started with a 6. It doesn't matter how, you know, what you know, what you don't know. It has been for centuries, for when you were a man, you automatically have, you know, a 6 rolled for you. So there's always this, you know, when you're a member of a group, you get some group points from that. So again, the main point is that our interactions are so complex, because we ourselves are a collection of so many attributes, that we really don't know. We don't know that's why the world seems to be random. But there are some attributes which are in control of us, which we control. There are a lot of, what our gender is, how old we are, how fat or thin we are, what color of our skin, you know, whether I have an accent or not, whether I look good in a suit or not. These things are things which I don't have a lot of control over. Because again, whether I look good in a suit, it means it's a function of you. You decide whether I look good in a suit or not. You decide whether I look like this guy looks like he's ready to take the next step in his career. It's not something which I can control, right? That's your subjective evaluation of me, which might not be based on any facts. So those are the things which I cannot control. And unfortunately, our world is that's really what it is. It's other people's perception of you that enables you to move forward. So whether my book sells a lot or doesn't sell, whether my book gets made into a movie, whether my cybersecurity book becomes the standard or it kind of vanishes without a trace, there's really nothing I can do about it, because it's based purely on other people's perception of me. And that too, that perception of me or my book isn't just based on what's inside the book. I mean, I published Sultan of Delhi on the week that it came out on the week that demonetization happened. I mean, what could I have done? So all this effort that I put into writing this book, it all burnt up. just because of the time that it went out. There's nothing I could have done about it. There's nothing anybody could have done about it, honestly. So these things happen. You know, shit happens. So the thing about disappointment is you realize that, you know, maybe that was, did it feel bad that, you know, that, yeah, but would it have led to something good? I don't know. Maybe if there had not been any demonetization, maybe I would have sold, you know, 2,000 more copies. But would it have made me more happy? Not likely. Would it have changed my fortunes forever? I don't think so. So, but was it devastating for me? Absolutely, when it happened. So, but when I think about it, now with some years, I say, either way, it wouldn't have changed much. And most of the things in life you'll realize are like that. Wouldn't have changed much. So that's the episode for today. I hope that it helped you understand what I believe time management is. I didn't tell you how I do time management, but I think you would have formed an idea about how I think about time management.
Right, but, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all kind of a recipe.
Yes, exactly. And again, since I don't know the context of whether that was a genuine question or not, that's why I didn't go into specific ways I do time management. But I just wanted to say in general, why I believe that some people run short of time and some people have so much time. It's because of the way they perceive the balance of time and money and time and relationships. It's not because they're carrying a Google calendar or that they fix everything in a little exercise book which they carry around with them. That's not really what it is. And in those time management tricks, you can just Google and find out in life hacks. I don't think there's anything new that I can say. But I think the more fundamental things about understanding the relationship between time, happiness, money, that I think is a vital insight. And that's really what I wanted to talk about today.
All right. The last part about, you know, where you said that life is a kind of half random and half in your hands, it also reminded me of, I don't know if you remember the last monologue in Forrest Gump, where Tom Hanks says, he says, I think Lieutenant Dang says that we are in control of our life. And I think Baba says it's predestination. I think it's a little bit of both. And it's a very lovely, I think that's the last scene of the movie. And it kind of, makes the same point that you did. I was remembering that. Now, dang, I feel like watching Forrest Gump again. I think that's our podcast for today. So we hope you really enjoyed this one. And as always, remember that the best way to show your appreciation is to head over to patreon.com/greatbong and support Arnab directly. So we look forward to having you back next week too. And until then, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.